each of you today to Mornings for the Master here on TGRN.org. That is the GospelRadioNetwork.org. We're certainly tickled to have this opportunity to talk with each of you this morning and even reach around the world with the gospel of Jesus Christ on this multimedia outlet. We're certainly tickled that our overseers have seen the need for such a device such as this, and we certainly heed the words of Jesus as he says, go into all the world. It didn't say how to do it, and so we have this opportunity here to go along one of those hows. You know, there's a lot of technology now that certainly has not been available in the past, and it's a great ability of the church to be able to use so very many of these avenues. We see in the chat window this morning that several of you have already checked in, and so we welcome Brother Chris. He has checked in and said good morning. Also, my bride is there, and good morning to you as well. Also, I see Miss Kay is in the chat window this morning, and so howdy do to you. And I see Miss Morgan is checked in down here in Winnsboro. I hope you're all better and feeling great, Miss Morgan, and I look forward to seeing you soon. Also, we want to make sure and salute those that regularly listen that maybe don't have opportunity or don't take opportunity for one reason or another on the chat window. And I know Miss Frida's out there listening this morning. Hope you're feeling well and warm and cozy in your new little abode there. So good morning to you. And good morning to all of you out there that are listening and have taken the opportunity to join in with us this morning. We're going to be looking to Genesis 37 to 41. I'm not sure exactly what's going on with our schedule here. Looks like Brother Chris has checked in and said I don't have to go quite as far as we had spoken, so I apologize for any hiccups with our schedule. But I prepared anyway, beginning at chapter 37 with the favoritism that we see, even in the house of Jacob. And so we'll start there, and we'll see how time goes this morning. But we have a real privilege to look at this particular piece of Scripture that opens up even, as the commentators have told us, the last and the tenth division of the book of Genesis, which is the generations of Jacob. And so we'll open that section of Scripture in a moment, but we'll remind you first of a few things on the bulletin board, as we normally do. We've been telling you about the Standing in the Gap lectureship that's going on up in, was this Nesbitt? Yeah, Nesbitt. I participated years ago in the very first, here it is, the 18th annual. Boy, that makes me feel old. I was in the School of Preaching at the time, and David Jones, a faithful gospel preacher, was one of the elders at that time that was able to start this. And so I was able to participate in that first one and speak, I think maybe even the second year. So it's neat to see this has progressed over these many years. But the topic this year is, how did we get the Bible? And, you know, there's a lot of questions about that. And so if you're not able to go and hear men in person like Keith Mosier and Don Walker and Dan Cates, and Robert Taylor Jr., so many powerful gospel preachers, then I would invite you to go to the Nesbitt website and, you know, even request recordings of this. Maybe it is, as they did back in the day, they might very well have printed material as well. I don't know. But that starts on January the 27th, coming up this Friday, and goes into the 29th, again, the 18th annual Standing in the Gap Lectures, How Do We Get the Bible, a fabulous forum there in Nesbitt, Mississippi. Also, as being promoted by our brother Grota over in North Jefferson, the Church of Christ there in Mount Pleasant, he is reminding us about the Give Me the Bible annual conference that is going to be taking place Saturday, January the 28th, again this weekend, over in Palestine. And the Crockett Road Church is taking care of that over there. And they have invited you to come and be a part of the meal that's going to be catered at noon. I believe there's an $8 charge for that. But it's not a very far way to go to have the opportunity to listen to Mark Engel talk about Let's Be Keen in 2017. And then Perry Cowan, as he addresses this subject, Let's Be Clean in 2017. And so certainly you have the opportunity to attend that this Saturday, beginning at 9 a.m. And if you want more information, you could call Brother Grota over there in Mount Pleasant at the North Jefferson Congregation, or you could get in touch with the Crockett Road Church of Christ there in Palestine, and they'd give you all the information that you might need about that. But anyway, we look to the next thing on the bulletin board here. We have a Ladies' Day that's coming up in Corsicana at the West Hill Church. And the topic is When Life Gives You Lemons. And Donna Drain is coming to be a part of that. And so if you can be a part of that, they've asked for you to RSVP even by today. And the number to do that is 903-872-5696. Also, our fourth annual Make Me a Servant workshop is coming up February the 3rd and 4th, beginning Friday night, with special attention given to the youth. Michael Light is going to begin at 7 o'clock that night and talk about lighting the fire, because we are discussing, even all through the day Saturday, rekindling the fire. And so we have men and women coming to speak. There'll be breakout classes during the day where the women study by themselves and where the men study by themselves. There's classes for the youth, even by Sean Embry, that has the opportunity to study with the men, the young men. And the ladies will be taught by such wonderful people like Marley Embry, his wife, and Carly Bond. And so come and be a part of that on Saturday the 4th, and even if you have opportunity, Friday the 3rd. Also coming up, not looking too far down the road here, there's the Carriage Oaks Congregation on February the 11th is going to have a workshop for Bible class teachers, and that's always a great opportunity. Ideas are swapped, materials are swapped, and so this is a great opportunity for anybody that teaches a class, a Bible class, to see how things are being done now. How things have changed, how we might better teach our students. And so if you have the opportunity to RSVP, they've asked you to call down there in Bossier City, and the number is 318-741-3016. They're going to have a lunch, and so, you know, they kind of need to know about how much material to have printed off and available, how much lunch to prepare. So if you can be there on February the 11th between 9 and 3 for this Bible class teacher's workshop, then make sure and RSVP with them. And we have several more things coming up on into March that we're going to be announcing even as the day draws closer. And so we'll announce those a little bit more as the day grows near. But since we do have a time restraint in front of us, even just under 50 minutes this morning to complete this passage, let's take an opportunity to jump into God's Word. I know that you've got your Bibles open and ready to go, and you're ready to study with us this morning. As I mentioned, and by the way, we don't have Brother Richard with us this morning. If you have wondered, he has a previous engagement that he had to meet. And so he's a very busy man, and we certainly will miss him this morning. But we look forward to your comments in the window. I can't walk and chew gum. I've told you that before, so I may not be able to type back to you, but I've got my setup in front of me where I can at least see your comments. So feel free to chime in along the way. And if I can be ambidextrous enough, I might even mention those comments along the way. I get kind of tunnel vision when we start this process, so hopefully I can jump in there and see what all of you have put there. So let's roll into this last section of Genesis. Again, this particular section is, you know, kind of divided by men, obviously, But that helps us to digest such a wonderful book as this that has 50 chapters. And so this particular section is the family of Jacob. All the families are broken up into these scriptures. You'll see the generations of that have been mentioned so many times before, and this is none different. So we go into the generations of Jacob, and what we see here ultimately is in this last section is that which was told of Abraham beginning to come to pass, right? So by the time you open up the book of Exodus and you see the people crying out because they are in bondage by the horrible taskmasters in Egypt, realize that that's exactly what Abraham was promised as early as what we read in our English Bibles in Genesis 15, early on in that record of Moses. So what we have here is that coming to pass. And so what we see in the generations of Jacob as this section opens is how they got to Egypt, right? How they came to be in this location, which ultimately, as you well know already, I'm sure, was God's plan from the beginning. You know, for God's people, they needed to be removed. What was Abraham called to do but to leave an idolatrous area like Ur? God's people need to have a place where they can center their minds, where they can focus, where he can be their God and they can be their people. They can be his people, rather. And that sounds a lot like the church, doesn't it? A called out group of people that can be focused, separated from the toils and turmoil, rather, of the world. And here's what we see. They're called out of, they're going to be called out of Egypt, right? They're going to be called out of this area that is surrounded. And again, in our study of Exodus, you'll see in the plagues, each of the plagues was an attack, an individual attack. Plague 1, Plague 2, Plague 3, etc., was an individual attack on one of their gods. And so God is knocking off their idols one at a time. Well, this is the surrounding, even here in Goshen, that they have, an idolatrous area. But this is talking about how they got there, right? And then we'll proceed in Exodus on how they got out. Obviously, the word Exodus, leaving, departure, the way out, the road out. And so what we begin with here by looking at chapter 37 is this idea of favoritism. As you begin in chapter 37, beginning in verse 1, especially 1 and 2, the Bible says, and read along with me, Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, and we'll notice that as we go through here, remember his age. By the time you get to chapter 41, I guess it is, we understand that as he sits in front of Pharaoh now in this great post that he's been given, he's 30 years old. So notice the time that's going to pass, that he has been removed from his family, okay? Just a side note there. So we see he was 17 years old, continuing our reading, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now, basically what you have here, if you break it down into our vernacular today, it was kind of like a tattletale situation. Now, he was certainly right for giving this information to his father. But, you know, when you're the one being told on, you'll take offense to that, won't you? And so from their vantage point, he's a tattletale. You need to mind your own business. Daddy doesn't need to know what we're doing. If we wanted Daddy to know what we were doing, we would have told Daddy what we were doing, right? So it's all in the eye of the beholder, really. But what we see here is he has taken whatever this evil is, we're not told. But he has taken this to Dad, right? Remember, Joseph is the firstborn of the favorite wife. And so Joseph finds favor in the eyes of his father, even more as we see coming up, than the other 11 brothers, right? And so we see this evil report. Verse 3, Israel loved Joseph. You see this? Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age and he made him a coat of many colors. Now, everybody that has had children, we'll say a plurality of children, just for this particular purpose, understands that you cannot show favoritism. It just does not work in the household, right? But again, what did we see even with Jacob and Esau? Mama liked Jacob and daddy liked Esau, right? And so we see a favoritism that seems like it's been passed down. Have you seen that? What is taught at home is carried out into the next generations, right? And so when you look back to such a proclamation like in Deuteronomy 30, beginning at about verse 18 or 19, where Moses stands before the people and he says, I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Choose life that both thou and thy seed might live. Notice that our choices have everything to do with future generations. And so here is just another example of something that's been passed down. Okay, even this idea of favoritism has been passed down. Remember how we see this lying about who your wife really is passed down even between Abraham and Isaac? You remember? And so we see these things being passed down, and I couldn't help but see that. Favoritism has moved now into this particular lineage. 11 children along, right? So years in the making. And favoritism rears its ugly head. And to put an exclamation point on it, he makes him a coat, unlike anything that the other children have. And so now we see this coat. We see the, air fingers quote, you can't see that at home, tattletaling, right? And so the animosity is growing. Verse 4, when his brethren saw that their father, okay, what he is doing is visible. It's not just subliminal, it's visible, right? When his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Isn't that a shame? You can't even say a nice word to your sibling. The hatred was caused because of this horrible favoritism. And so favoritism doesn't work in the home. And if you might stretch that out just a little bit, it doesn't work in the church either, right? And so favoritism is a plague. And as the scriptures continue, beginning at verse number 5, notice as these dreams roll out, which show them bowing before Joseph, right? The one that they hate so much. It's just boiling over at this point. It's getting worse, right? So Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. So now we see that it is really under their skin. It's getting worse. And so he tells them this particular dream. I know you're familiar with it. And they understand exactly what he's talking about, that we're going to bow before you. We're going to serve you, right? And then in the second dream, he includes mom and dad. Now, at this particular time, you remember, you know, mom is gone, but nevertheless, the family structure is mentioned. And all of you are going to be bowing down, right? Now, right in the second one, even as father and mother are added, dad rebukes him, right? And so that's kind of odd with the favoritism, you know, that's being expressed. You think that it would go unnoticed, but dad does take the opportunity to rebuke him. But nevertheless, it doesn't do anything to heal the situation between the 11 brothers. So here we have this dream scenario that's rolled out, two different dreams, both of which are one, both are given by God, you know, and it's interesting the way this rolls out. I mean, God doesn't make any mistakes, does he? Never has, never will. And so we think sometimes, you know, he could have kept this to himself. Well, sure, he could have, but it is recorded here that he spoke up in both occasions. Now, obviously, in this day and time, as we're dealing with the patriarchal system, God speaking to the household heads, God communicating with man, even through this medium, as you will see over and again, even in Egypt, as this comes up, dreams are some great way of communication, and interpretations are absolutely necessary, and they are vital. We'll see that, you know, certainly with Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. We'll see all of these things playing out as the days roll forward with other characters as well. But here we have these two dreams. We see the hatred continuing, and now this particular scenario, this account, that opens up in front of us beginning at verse 12 when Joseph is asked to go down by his father and check on the brothers, make sure everything's okay. So as it unrolls in front of you, Dad sends Joseph into Shechem. He says, go check on your brothers and see how everything's going. He gets to Shechem. Nobody there. One of the inhabitants there says, hey, they've gone on down to Dothan. They were here, but they have moved on down the road. So you find him going down to find them, even in Dothan. And beginning at about verse 16 or 17 here, he says, the man said, they are departed. I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren. Now, as I understand it geographically, going over to Shechem was about 50 miles. And so that's a pretty good trek. Whether you're on foot or whether you're on beast, it's a pretty good move. And so then when he got there 50 miles later and did not find his brethren, he goes on to Dothan. And again, I think I've got the math right. It's about 15 miles. So here he's traveled 65 miles from the behest of his father to do his father's will and come down here to a group of guys that hate his guts, to use our own vernacular. 65 miles he's traveled, and look, here comes the dreamer, right? They can see him coming. Even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him, verse 18. So in my mind, I'm seeing the coat of many colors in a distance, standing out loud and proud. And no one else has a coat like that, right? So who else could it be but the dreamer? Here comes the dreamer. Here comes our brother that we hate. Let's kill him. I don't know about you, but whenever one of my family members comes close to me, that's not something that comes even close to the forefront of my mind. So notice where we are. Let's kill him. Can you think for a moment, and isn't that just a horrible thing to even begin to conspire? Now, recognize they've been living in this land as a stranger, and it seems, if I haven't read too much into this, it seems that the ways of the heathen people have rubbed off on this family. Else, why would they think such a horrible thing? Well, you need to be careful who you hang out around then, right? The people have evidently rubbed off on this family. Now, the firstborn, beginning in verse 21, Reuben, he says, No. I got another plan. We can't kill him. I mean, he's our own flesh and blood after all. Well, thank goodness for Reuben. But he comes up with an alternate plan. Let's throw him in a hole over here. And then when the brothers weren't looking, he could come back and he could take him out and get him back home to safety, right? Well, as you know, that fell apart as Reuben had departed and gone to do another chore, another job while he was away from the table where they were eating, while he was away from them for a period of time, they sell Joseph. And so you see the plans start to develop in verse number 23, and they decide that they're going to make up this story, this fabricated event. And so notice the first thing they did as you continue through verse 25, they stripped him of his coat, and they threw him in the well. this bottomless pit, as it were. If you're in it, it seems like a bottomless pit. Smooth sides, as we have read through archaeology accounts, that would be unable for you to cause you to be unable to climb out. Deep enough where you might be standing in a foot of water or something, you know, just nasty enough to cause certainly loneliness and despair, anxiety. And so Judah says, hey, here comes some traitors. Could we not sell our brother? And he'd be gone. He'd be out of our eyesight. So for 20 pieces of silver, sound like Judas? For 20 pieces of silver, Joseph is out of their hair. Gone forever in their minds. And so the plan comes to fruition. They dip the coat in the blood and they send it on down the line, maybe even by a messenger. But they send this account. Dad, do you recognize this coat? If it's Joseph's, then maybe it's the case that he's been devoured by wolves, been devoured by animals or something. And so then as the chapter ends, you see this great lamenting of their father. You know, I've, through the years, through mistakes that I've made, I've caused my father to be in despair, my earthly father and my heavenly father. And now that I look back on that, that's very hurtful. Couldn't imagine why I would ever do such a thing. And later, as they, in the chapter, as they come to meet Joseph again, as they have time to talk one with another while they've been cast into the Egyptian jail, periods like that, you know, their consciences are really eating at them. They are terribly upset by what they have done. And even after Daddy dies, towards the end of the book, they know that Joseph's going to kill them. But certainly he does not do that. See, there's a lot going on within this household. And we see that in the brothers treating even of Joseph. And so here we have Joseph gone now. He has been moved on into Egypt. And then we have what seems to be kind of an interlude maybe here with chapter number 38, where we're introduced to the problems in Judah's household. You know, we have the privilege as men in this society. God has given us the authority to be heads over our homes, to be leaders, to be examples for others, even around us. You know, back in Genesis, what was it, 13, where Abraham and Lot were having their strife. You remember that it says that the Hittite, the Perizzite, and they list several nations were already in the land. You know, people are watching how we act. People are watching how we deal with strife and anxiety and turmoil. And I'm seeing here, again, Judah's influence by those that are around him. Because as we see what happens in this particular chapter with Tamar and the event that unfolds there, we understand that he's not such a good leader at this point. He's not been such a good dad, maybe. But we see Judah's family opening. Verse number 1 of chapter 38, it came to pass that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Dullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he took her and went unto her. She conceived and bare a son. He called his name Ur. She conceived again, had another son named Onan, and she conceived again and had a son named Shelah, right? So here's three sons born to Judah by a Canaanite woman, right? So just like the past, just like the scenarios that have been playing out in front of us, behind us, they have taken wives that they shouldn't have, right? What was it that Jacob saw about Isaac's, or Abraham saw about Isaac's wife? He says, go to my people, go to my kindred, and you find a wife for Isaac there. And don't take him with you, right? You see, there is proper leadership that we can see in a household, and we have to be careful even about helping our children to choose their mates, right? Your mate is going to be somebody that you date. So be careful who you date. And so here we see Judah choosing a wife, even of the Canaanite people, giving birth to three sons, as we have recorded in front of us. We come to find out that Ur was an evil individual, verses 6 and 7, and God slew him. We don't know how, we don't know what the evil was, but, you know, you look back, and we don't often have those records. We understand that their imaginations in Genesis 6 were beyond even our comprehension. There was evil all the time, and God slew an entire earth full of people, however many that may have been at the time. But now we see a second son, Onan. We understand him, that he was going to be an evil individual as well. And so Onan, has been the first one to die now. And Onan certainly has the opportunity. He says, go in unto your brother's wife. You know, Ur has died, dead, and so he has the opportunity now by family law to go in and be a husband and raise up seed after his brother's name, right? And so as I understand it, the firstborn would be, you know, according to their laws, the inheritor of that which was Ur's. Well, Onan does that which he is not supposed to do. I won't be too terribly graphic here at this point, but God slew him too. And so now Judah's, two of three of Judah's sons are dead because they have violated God's law. Now remember that God is bringing about the birth of Jesus Christ through this lineage. And so when God has a plan, you best not go against it. And so here's two individuals that have already been taken out of the picture by God. The third son is now available for marriage to this young lady, Tamar. And, you know, Judah's like, man, I'm not so sure that this is a good idea. You know, I don't want to lose a third son. And so we see this plan come into fruition as we begin in verse number 12. In the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers in Timnath and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So remember, in history now, we understand, Brother Chris puts in there, error. It all adds up, right? Absolutely. that's a good point. That'll preach right there. That'll wax bold. Here we have this period of the sheep shearing. As I understand Hebrew history, this was a time of frolic. It was a time of feast. It was a time of partying, good times, if you will. And so they go up to Timnath in the mountains of Judah. Now, Tamar was told where Judah was going, right? And so since Tamar is wearing a widow's clothing at this point, we see that is revealed by Moses in this recording, even by inspiration, that she changes clothes and she puts on a harlot's garment and she goes up to deceive Judah. And so you could stop right here for a moment. And you could talk about our dress. What? Yeah, absolutely. Because the way we present ourselves tells others something about us. There's times, I guess even today, I have a head covering on, you know, because I've been on my motorcycle. I have, you know, a jacket that I wear, gloves. People see you walk into a store like that, and they say, "You riding your motorcycle?" You know, the way you dress tells people something. Well, absolutely. I'm on my motorcycle. They can tell. Here, she's dressed in such a way that they can tell she's a harlot. So what does that tell us, dads, as we dress our daughters? Grandfathers, as you see your granddaughters leaving the house, what is she telling the world? What are our young men telling the world as they leave the house? Take that into consideration. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be an harlot, verse 15. So here is this opportunity for him to go in unto her. They lie together. As you know, as it unfolds in front of you, she is going to conceive. But as they lie together now, he says, I'm going to give you a goat as payment. In the 21st century, that does seem a little bit odd, obviously, but in the day, that was a very valuable object. He didn't have a goat with him. He said, look, when I go back home, I'll get one and I'll bring it back to you. And she says, well, until you do that, let me hold something of yours. And he says, okay, well, what do you want? And so it is the case that he gives her his signet and the chain that goes with it, evidently, something that you can seal a letter, something that'll something that says it's you. This is Judah's mark. And a staff, which he carries, which in this day, I understand, even Richard explained it in our class, that it was something that was carved, molded in some fashion, that it was distinctive to the individual carrying it. So you remember, as it would come up in law some years later, in the mouth of two or three witnesses should such a thing be considered, right? And so when you go to court, you don't just have one witnesses, you have a plethora of witnesses, right, to make your case sure. Well, here I couldn't help but seeing that she's got two or three witnesses, not just one thing that could have been maybe even taken by surprise or taken under guise, but she has two or three witnesses, right? The chain, the signet, and the staff. All of these things have been secured by Tamar now. Chris says, any man recognizes the attire of the harlot. Why would any father let his daughter have the house virtually attired as a harlot as they go out to school or into the community? Good point, Brother Chris. Need to be cognizant of what's going on in our own households. So here we have this this idea coming forward that this trade has been made with promise to be paid sometime later when he comes back to find her as it unfolds in front of us. But we see that when he does come back, he can't find her, right? She's not to be found, because she's gone away. She's gone back and put on her widow's attire. And so as it lays out in front of us, verse 24, beginning, it came to pass about 3 months after that this was told to Judah, saying, hey, look, Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot. And also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. Well, as she comes forth and to face her accusers, as the scripture continues, she sent her father to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose things these are, I am with child. And she said, discern, I pray thee, whose are these? The signet, the bracelets, and the staff. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because that I gave her to Shelah my son. I gave her not, rather, to Shelah my son. And he knew her again no more. You know, this is the situation similar to what we see in 2 Samuel 12. Remember when Nathan comes to Daniel, tells him about the little ewe lamb, the situation that is even like a parable. And David says, whoever did this, he needs to die. And Nathan said, I'm talking about you. Thou art the man. And here, the same thing unfolds in front of Judah. Let her be burnt. Let her be killed. And then Tamar says, thou art the man. You know, what a moment in time. I bet you could hear a pin drop. Well, Certainly, our sin has to be acknowledged. There is several points of reference that we could preach here and wax bold on. One of them is acknowledging sin. You know, until you acknowledge a problem, you can't move forward. That's probably one of seems like I remember that's one of the tenets of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you have to first come to the recognition that I have a problem, and then you move forward with the other steps. In that particular program, I've not been in that program, don't get me wrong, but I think that's what I remember. You know, and that's true spiritually. We must acknowledge that we have sinned. We have to make that confession. And certainly, as you read 1 John 1, we understand that God is faithful and just to forgive us. But what we have to do first? Confess. Right? Same thing that Simon the Sorcerer would face over in Acts, was it 8? The same problems that have been confronting man for many years, thousands of years. We have to confront our sin. Well, as we move forward, after Judah has acknowledged his sin, we read about verses 27 to about 30, the birth of Phares and Judah, the sons of this union. And we understand that they were twins. One began to come out. And so knowing that there was twins within the womb, the first child's arm is marked with a red cord, and he draws his hand back in, and another child comes forward. And so they knew that this was the second-born son. Well, there's a lot to that, right? Because these details are recorded even by inspiration of God. Because there's a link in Jesus' genealogy here. So Perez, the firstborn, was the one, as we see through the genealogical process, through whom Jesus came, right? And so this is something that often we read over, you know, so-and-so begat, who begat, who begat, who begat, the son of, the daughter of, and we miss those points from time to time. But notice how, as the children came out, there is a process that is marked, even with this red cord. Even as the cord that would be hung in Rahab's window that would signify salvation in the household, even the color of the blood that would flow from the side of Jesus, that would flow from man's salvation, the red cord that's mentioned. Interesting, isn't it? Beginning at Genesis chapter 39... we see Joseph here. Remember, we had like an interlude there so we could see what's going on in Judah's house. And so we kind of get back to the narrative that we talked about even in chapter 37, right? He was sold into slavery, and Genesis 39 introduces us to him in Egypt. And he's sold into the ownership of this one man named Potiphar. Again, this is one of those things that we have read from a young child, and so I know you're quite familiar with it. But notice the beginning. Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian. Notice all of these details that are given to us. An officer of Pharaoh, right? Power, prestige, captain of the guard, great responsibility. Again, prestige, honor, power. An Egyptian, okay, not a Semite or you know these other individuals from the land. Egyptians culturally were opposed to people outside of Egypt. And that plays out if you'll look down the corridor of time as they came to Goshen. The family came to Goshen. Notice they were placed in Goshen. Because they hated shepherds. You know, they couldn't stand a shepherd. So put them out there in the field. Let them live over there. Don't let them live in downtown Egypt, right? So anyway, he was an Egyptian. And this man bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought them down thither. So here's the company of Ishmaelites. Now, you might remember earlier the Midianites. Well, the Ishmaelites and Midianites, this is a term that's used synonymously. A whole lot we could say about that, but there is a history there. But this is the same situation. Joseph hadn't changed hands. It's the same group of people, but it's a different wording here. So Ishmaelites, Midianites, same thing, not to be confusing. And notice verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. Now, I like the way when Richard did our class, he made the first point here in verse number 2 as this is the theme for chapter 39. Because as you notice, I wrote this down in verse 3, verse 5, verse 21, and verse 23. If you'll make those little check marks, notice the same thing appears, that God was with Joseph. And, you know, as we checked off and noticed the pronunciation here, the same thing should be recognized with us. As obedient newborn Christians, as those that are righteous, as those that are seen favorably in the eyes of God. Was it 1 Peter 3:12? I better look that up before I quote it. We understand that his eyes are upon the righteous. And so what does that say about Joseph? His eyes are upon the righteous. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And we see here that Joseph finds favor in the eyes of the Lord. And so continuously through this chapter, in those particular places especially, we see the pronunciation that God is with Joseph. And what happens to those that are around the righteous? Well, there's normally some sort of blessing that is associated, right? What happened with Laban, right? Laban recognized, hey, something's going on here. Oh, God is with him. That's what's going on. Well, you remember the promise to Abraham, right? God is going to bless those that are around the righteous. And so even the problems that Lot would have, he would be blessed by being around Abraham. So many things that we could talk about, but notice that God was with him. And his master, verse 3, saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he had, all that he did to prosper in his hand. You and I might say everything he touched turned to gold. Had that Midas touch, right? And so Potiphar saw what was going on and he recognized, hey, this kid is something special. Remember, 17 years old. This young man is something special. Now, beginning in verse 5, it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house, and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian house for Joseph's sake. There's another one of our mentions. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And in the final verse, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not all he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. You know, the only thing that Potiphar gave attention to, as the scriptures are showing here, is what he ate for dinner. And so he didn't have to worry about anything under his care because Joseph was just that good and that dependable. Interesting. In Kyle and Delish's commentary, they have said about this particular verse, he left to Joseph everything that he had and did not trouble himself about anything but his own eating. That's kind of the way I was thinking. This is the idea of stewardship, a man to be a steward over all that you have. And so he can give his devotion, his attention to his business, the business of being captain of the guard and all the things that he had going on in his life. Well, as we get into the person of Joseph, we see that he was a goodly person and well-favored, and we get into the idea of his looks. And we're going to find out that as the son of Rachel, you look back into Genesis 29, you understand that Rachel was a beautiful person, certainly easy to look at. I guess you could say words like that. And we read the same, again, as Richard pointed out to us in class some time ago, that in 1 Samuel 16, in verse number 12, David is mentioned the same way, easy to look at. And his son Absalom, 2 Samuel 14, and verse number 25. Absalom was a beautiful young man. And so we see this same type of thing unfolding in front of us as it relates to Joseph. And so as verse 7 begins, and we see Potiphar's wife chasing him around the house, if you will, it came to pass after these things, those things that are just mentioned, that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." And he refused, verse 8, and said, "Behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in this house, and he hath committed all that he hath into my hand. There is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and, sin against God?" Notice he didn't say sin against Potiphar. He didn't say sin against you, Potiphar's wife. He said, "What you want me to do, what you want me to commit in this room with you right now is a sin against God." And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day. Now, this wasn't a one-time act. She's hounding him day after day. And again, step back for a minute. Raise your hands out there. How many of you have been 17 years old? Okay, look at all the hands raised up, right? Now, you remember, you know, what it is to be a 17-year-old, right? There's certain hormones, there's certain things that are going on in your body. And so this must have been an intense temptation for him. But day by day by day, he continues to say no. And so we see the great example that would be seen even in Matthew 4 as Jesus over and again says no. 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 You know what? If Jesus could do it, I can do it. You know what? If Joseph could do it, I can do it. We must say no to sin. But she was a persistent woman. We understand through history that the Egyptian women were kind of promiscuous and that it was almost acceptable to be promiscuous. Kind of like it is today. That's something to swallow, isn't it? Well, he's bombarded with this. And so as verse 11 opens up, Joseph went into the house to do his business, and there was no men in the house. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." Here's another. Here she has pulled him up to her with his coat, and this time he has to run, because things are getting serious. She has attached herself to him, and so in his fleeing, he just runs right out of his coat. And so here she's left, you know, embarrassed. And she's got his coat, and she uses this as evidence of the wrong that he's committed. And that's the way she plays it. And so she tells everybody in the house, she tells her husband, she tells Potiphar, "Look at what this young man has done. And it was only when I screamed rape," or whatever it was that she screamed, "it was only then that he ran and left his coat behind." Well, she has fabricated a lie, has told a lie on this young man. And then when Potiphar comes in, he has to do something. Now, the way that I read the scripture, it almost seems evident, just, you know, maybe reading in again too much, that he's more upset with her than he is with Joseph. I mean, Joseph is a great asset to him. You know, and now you're cramping my style, woman, you know. What? Now I'm going to have to do something. You're going to inconvenience me now. And so if I understand right, the charge that is before us is worthy of death, right? But he just tosses him into prison. Now, remember, he's over the prison. So, again, he hasn't moved him too far away from him. It might even be in the same building, the way things were arranged. I don't know. But he didn't move him too far away. And then, as you see in tomorrow's study, even beginning at verse 21, you'll see how that he's still used, even by the head of the prison, and still has God's favor. So, here, his anger flares up, and certainly he has to do something so he wouldn't be a laughing stock, or so that he wouldn't be that guy. And so he just throws him into prison, which again was not really what should have been done legally. And so again, we see really that God continues to be with Joseph. And so what we've seen here is the entrance of God's people into Egypt. And then we'll see the exit of God's people as the book of Exodus begins to open, and the charge in chapter 3 that comes to the servant Moses to bring them out. And what a great opportunity that is going to be. Look, I have run out of time this morning. I did get to a point where I believe Brother Chris will pick up even tomorrow. And I hope you'll be with us for that. I'm grateful for this opportunity. I'm glad that each of you have been here. Thank you so much to Chris and Kay and Jody and all of you that have been in the chat window this morning. You, Miss Ann, we're grateful that y'all were here. Thank you for being with us, and we look forward to more great broadcasting on TGRN.org as the day rolls forward. God bless each of you, and continue to smile. We love each one of you. Good day.
Listening to Mornings for the Master on the Gospel Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock." Let's show the wisdom of that builder and go now to live for the Master.